So apparently, the so-called authorities are bringing back the nonsense again. And because they're bringing back the nonsense, we decided that we're going to bring back the end of COVID. Of course, I take the position, and yeah, I'm biased. I'm the lead producer on it, but I take the position that if, even just the freedom movement, even just half of the freedom movement or a quarter of the freedom movement understood and embodied what is presented during the end of COVID, there is no chance that any of this, even with them threatening, even with them coercing, even with them propagandizing us, will ever be able to happen again. So, for that reason, we're bringing back the end of COVID for a free replay period from October 1st through the 11th. And with that, we wanted to share one of my favorite sessions during the end of COVID with Meredith Miller called The State of Captivity. So, that's what this episode will be. Just a feature of one of the episodes from the end of COVID, and it's really incredible talking about Stockholm syndrome and this sort of dynamic between us and these so-called authority figures who are gaslighting us, coercing us, manipulating us, etc., etc. But once we're aware, we can step out and truly become free. And we talk about quite a bit of things during the end of COVID to really help people break free, quite literally, and then also mentally, right? So with that, like I said, October 1st through the 11th, that's when the free replay period will be. And we've already opened this up, but I just want to reiterate one more time that the affiliate program we've set up for the end of COVID is open to anyone. So if you'd like to share this material with those around you and earn money in doing so, please sign up to become an affiliate. We'll link that in the show notes. And we're honoring affiliate commissions through December 21st. So you can share as much as you want, even right now, with the release of this episode, as much as you want, whenever you want, to help people really break through the illusions and become free. And that's the whole point of the end of COVID, covering every single thing that happened over the last 3.5 years and beyond so that we can ensure this nonsense never happens again. And here we are with them trying to do all of the nonsense again. So very timely that we're putting this out October 1st through the 11th, free replay period. Last thing on that is the minimum price to purchase during the free replay period. So it is free. You can watch the end of COVID totally for free at your own pace, October 1st through the 11th. But the price to purchase will go down from a minimum of $111 to $77 during the free replay period. So thanks for tuning in. I think you'll really enjoy this session with Meredith Miller. Meredith, thank you for joining me. I had the pleasure of watching your presentation to medical doctors for COVID ethics, and it was on the sort of psychological torture, for lack of a better term, that so many people endured over the last 3 years. And I think four different people reach out to me saying, "You have got to have Meredith Miller on." I'm like, "Oh my God, why did I even think of that?" Because we had also interviewed you for my previous organization, Health Freedom for Humanity. I got the second half of your presentation to medical doctors for COVID ethics, and I'm like, "This has to be featured as a part of the end of COVID." So obviously, we know that the psychological component of what went on the last 3 years goes way deeper than people really understand, especially the ability to induce real symptoms of illness. And you're going to be discussing that and some as it pertains to the psychological abuse that people endured. So I'll turn it over to you for your presentation.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen. You can see my screen? Awesome. So the psycho-neuro-spiritual state of captivity that I'm going to talk about is essentially the Stockholm syndrome. It's known by other names like the trauma bond or traumatic entrapment, but essentially what it results in is a state of captivity. It doesn't have to be physical captivity. Often when we hear the word captivity, we think of like a hostage situation or some kind of captivity in that way. Just like when we hear the term abuse, people often think domestic violence or physical abuse, when actually abuse can also be more invisible and psychological. So essentially it results in this state of captivity, and it's psychological, neurological, and spiritual. That's why I've named it like this. And this is going to explain how the violation of consent took place during COVID. And I think this is important not only to understand what happened, but also to understand this is the same tactic that they're going to be using in further crises that they either manufacture or take advantage of in the future. They're just going to keep copying and pasting the same thing. So we're going to look today at a micro to macro vision bridge of the abuse dynamics. So essentially, again, this is psychological abuse. We're going to look at the abuse cycle, which is also called a cycle of violence. And that cycle of violence causes a trauma bond or the Stockholm syndrome or traumatic entrapment, or again, what I've named that psycho-neuro-spiritual state of captivity. The goal here is to get your compliance. So the abuser has to get your compliance. The more covert the abuser is, the more they need your voluntary consent. The covert abusers are just more sophisticated and subtle and hidden than the overt abusers. And of course, we saw some very overt abuse take place in 2020. But predominantly what we saw and how they got people to comply was very covert. So they need your voluntary consent that way they can maintain their image as it's just for your good and it's for your protection and it's because they care. And also what happens is they want to get your irrational loyalty. This is a term that Dr. Patrick Karnes came up with when he did his research on the trauma bonding that takes place in abusive relationships. And he found that the victim is irrationally loyal to this perpetrator who's hurting and abusing them. And the goal is also to get your emotional dependency, not only on the perpetrator, but also on the abusive system, because we don't live in isolation. So even, let's say, in a relationship, that relationship also exists in a social system, whether it's a family or a group of friends or a workplace, or even on the macro vision where we're talking about society, which is a very large social system. So in the case of the global abuse that took place, the compliance that they wanted to get was for people to follow the COVID measures, which started with the social distancing, masking, testing, et cetera. They wanted people to get vaxxed, and they wanted people to get other people to get vaxxed. And essentially the bigger picture is they want to transition us into the digital slavery system. So the four parameters that induce the state of captivity are isolation, an act of perceived kindness, a perceived life threat, and a perceived inability to escape. So I'm going to dissect and explain each one of these, and I'm going to give specific examples that took place since 2020 to show us exactly how these played out. So that first parameter is isolation. And again, we have to look at both the physical and the psychological dimensions. So physical isolation is very easy to see. The psychological isolation is a lot more difficult to notice. It's equally damaging, if not more so. The key to the isolation is to deny the target access to outside perspectives, because the goal of every perpetrator is to get the target to be fully subscribed to the perpetrator's narrative. And so when we talk about the COVID narrative, this is what we're talking about. So the result of that isolation is a complete domination of the perception of reality. So the interesting thing is that social isolation also induces a state of disconnection. And our autonomic nervous system, through neuroception, is constantly scanning the environment for cues of safety or threat. When our autonomic nervous system senses disconnection, that social disconnection, it reads it as unsafe. It reads it as danger and life threat. And then what happens is the autonomic nervous system, without our awareness, because it's autonomic, arises into this state of defensiveness. What does that mean? Fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. So we often hear about fight or flight. Sometimes we don't know there's two others. Freeze, I'm going to explain soon. And fawning is essentially people pleasing, which is essentially the compliance that they're trying to get through all of these tactics. So when we're in that state of defensiveness, when the defensive system is activated in the autonomic nervous system, our attachment system is offline. Our attachment system is our ability to form social connections. So even though we may have the perception of being in connection, when we're in one of those defensive states, we're not really connecting. The autonomic nervous system is not reading that as safe and social, and we're not actually forming a social attachment. What they also found in science is that prolonged isolation causes chronically elevated stress hormones, and that changes the nervous system over time, and it affects our ability to form social bonds. And then when we're given the opportunity to socialize after the prolonged isolation, people are more irritable and aggressive. And I think now, 3 years into this, we can all notice that, you know, in the news headlines or even what we're observing in society, out and about or online, people are most certainly more irritable and aggressive. Violence is at a whole other level than it was before 2020. So specific examples of the isolation. Early on, we saw the domestic confinement, the social distancing, stay at home, the elder abuse, where the elderly were isolated in care homes. They were denied access to their family, to any kind of advocate. They were sent to the hospital alone. They were left to die alone. Maybe y'all saw a news headline back in 2020 at a care home in, I think it was Colorado. A bunch of elderly people were sitting outside, all isolated from one another in wheelchairs. And one woman had a sign and it said, "I would rather die of COVID than loneliness."
Yeah, that was abuse. It was unbelievable to see that.
Horrible. Horrible. And so for the psychological isolation, what we saw was the technological delivery of the messaging. So initially people were isolated physically at home, but what did everybody have? A phone, a tablet, a TV, a computer. So everybody was involved in all this messaging. They got it through the news media, through social media, through their friends and family, and through corporations who were all in lockstep. So let's say you visited a corporate website, or you got an email with a corporate newsletter, or you went to a corporate store, like you went to the grocery store and you're walking around shopping, and in the background, constantly bombarding your subconscious is the loudspeaker saying, stay 6 feet apart, stay home, order delivery, mask up, get vaxxed, et cetera. So there was this constant bombardment of the perpetrator's narrative. The information control is essentially how the psychological isolation is carried out. That's always the very first sign of the abuse, when a person is controlling the information. That was what initially ticked me off, that this is what was happening in 2020, when I realized how much information control, the censorship, the propaganda, the fact-checking, the bombardment, and then also the silencing and smearing of any alternative narratives, including doctors. You know, and even if we're to subscribe to the virology and everything that they say, I think it was clear, or it should have been clear to everyone, that when doctors are being censored during a pandemic, we have a problem.
Absolutely. Irrespective of belief on virus, because that's a whole separate issue. If there are doctors who clearly see that something is up, and there were a lot of them, and luckily people like you and I had the wherewithal to understand that and go searching for them, but so many other people weren't exposed to doctors across the spectrum of alternative viewpoints that were countering what the mainstream was saying.
Exactly. Exactly. It was a huge red flag. So the second parameter is the act of perceived kindness. This is part of the abuse cycle. So the abuse cycle is intermittent reinforcement. It goes back and forth between sweet and mean, kind and cruel, chaos and calm. So right now we're in the calm state, even though not everything is calm, it's relative calm. And essentially the abuse cycle is still ongoing, but we have the perception of normality right now. The key here is perceived. So the perceived kindness, it doesn't matter whether it's real, genuine kindness or whether the nervous system interprets that as kindness when it's actually love bombing. And love bombing is a term we use to describe false kindness. It's like flattery or showering someone with gifts or showering someone with some kind of act of kindness, seeming kindness. But actually, it's just a seduction. It's just to soften the person, to get them to relax their guard, to get them to extend trust to the perpetrator. So that, of course, is the goal of the perceived kindness. And also, as soon as the target starts to wake up, starts to leave the situation, or the perpetrator thinks they're losing control over the target, they once again use the perceived kindness to try to pull the target back in. So what that does is it induces a state of cognitive dissonance. This is like a deep inner conflict. It's like in an abusive relationship, a person is going to go back and forth between knowing something is off, something's wrong, they're not being treated right. Maybe they can even acknowledge that this person they're with is abusive, but then there's this other part of their mind that really wants to believe in the good of this person, that really wants to believe this is the love of their life. They really do care. They're actually changing. They're starting to take responsibility for things and everything's going to go back to normal or be okay. And so what that cognitive dissonance does is it like short circuits the brain into a state of denial. So essentially it's a defense mechanism. It's a survival mechanism. That conflict is so overwhelmingly stressful for the mind to hold these two completely opposite ideas and perceptions of reality that the person will go back into denial, or they'll be a little more conscious of the cognitive dissonance and they'll be more defensive. So probably you and everyone can relate at some point during the last few years, maybe you found some piece of evidence and it was irrefutable. And you tried to show it to somebody that, you know, we're being lied to, we're being deceived. And the person said, I can't look at that because if that's true, I can't exist in the world in which that's true. That's
I think so many people underestimate or cannot fathom the level of evil required to perpetrate this whole thing, especially from the tippy top, setting aside the people who were dealing with the conditioned beliefs themselves. But that's just the reality, is that they play on the kindness of people, like people's ability to never fathom evil like this existing because they themselves are not that evil. So they just can't possibly believe that this level of evil could occur.
Exactly. Just like the person wants to believe in the good of their husband or their mother or whomever. A lot of people want to believe that the government really cares about them, the media, the corporations, or like you said, the fact that evil like this just can't possibly exist. You know, they want to believe in the good of humanity and that all people are essentially good at the core, but that is not true. Yeah, so the result of this, you know, the intermittent reinforcement, the kindness, the cruelty, that inconsistency of the reward or praise actually causes the target to work harder, to invest more, and to develop an almost obsession with compliance. And I think we could see some clear examples of that, particularly in 2020, when you saw like how some people were just so obsessed with complying with the measures. And so some specific examples of the perceived kindness where, you know, they'd lock us down and then they would restore some freedoms or loosen some restrictions. They offered us the free vaccine. They offered us incentives to stay home and not work, like government stimulus money, unemployment benefits, mortgage and student loan forbearance. There were rewards and lottery systems to get vaccinated. And, you know, they could offer up to $1 million. Some states offered guns and trucks and French fries. In Las Vegas, they even offered a free lap dance at the strip club if you got your vax there. They also gave us promises of safety. So they said things like, it's for your protection. It's because we care. It's to keep you safe. And then the interesting one too is the dosing of little truths here and there. So, you know, when little things would come out and everybody would think, oh, finally, the truth is coming out. It's finally going to end, you know, and it stokes your hope. It's just like in an abusive relationship where the abuser every now and then will admit a little bit of accountability and responsibility. And then the target thinks, oh, finally, you know, they see the wrong of their ways. They're going to change. Yeah. It's the same thing. So really, this perceived kindness just keeps people in it. So the third parameter is the perceived life threat. This is delivered through the bombardment of fear messaging. Fear is the tool of compliance. It's the currency of control. The key here is the term perceived, because again, the nervous system doesn't care if it's a real threat, a real life threat, or it's not a real life threat. What matters is what it perceives. So the goal of this fear bombardment and life threat is that cues of a life threat induce a freeze state in the autonomic nervous system. It's also referred to as a collapse or immobilization. So if you're immobilized, what you're not doing is thinking and taking action. So the image here is, you know, a cat catches a mouse and the mouse goes completely limp. It fiends death in the mouth of that cat. Literally, the autonomic nervous system is shutting down the respiration, the heart rate, all of these bodily functions to fiend death. So that's what happens. We become petrified, immobilized when we're bombarded with fear. And so the result here is that people become closed off to new information. There's also that shutdown and collapse causes a metabolic shutdown. So, you know, of course people gained weight because they were staying home. The gyms were closed. They were told not even to go outside to exercise, but also there was the additional level of the metabolic shutdown, which is why we saw so much weight gain during the lockdowns. And interestingly, that fear bombardment also causes decreased immunity. And this has long been known in science. So of course they knew that. And you would think that if they really cared about our good and they really wanted to protect us and they really wanted us to be safe and healthy, that the public health measures would not be advocating for something that was decreasing the immunity. And this is, again, if we're to believe in that whole virology thing.
Well, another example of that real quick is that the CDC published a study in July of 2021 studied over 500,000 people in hospital settings that died with a COVID death label. And the second strongest risk factor for death associated with COVID was fear/anxiety related disorders.
Right. Exactly. So the other thing that fear bombardment causes is a numbing. So when we are overwhelmed, and again, that's the nervous system, when it's overwhelmed with stress and that's emotional pain that's happening, there are actually endogenous opioids produced by our own body that numb everything out. So if we're numbed out, we're not even able to feel our situation and to sense what's going on. And that becomes a negative cycle. It also causes brain fog. So it becomes very difficult to think clearly. People have muddy thinking. It's difficult to process information, particularly new information. It's hard to think through the fear, right? And it ends up causing people to feel very lost and alone. And because we can't stay physiologically in that state of collapse long term, that fiending death response is meant to be a last-ditch effort to survive, and it's only meant to last for, you know, a short period of time. But when this is ongoing over time, we adapt to this state through dissociation. So what that means is, like, we check out. There's like a split between the mind and the body. People zone out. They're not really there. You might be sitting next to them, but you feel like you can't connect to them because they're not really there. That's dissociation. And so when we're dissociated, we're not able to sense and feel what's going on. We're not able to feel our bodies and our intuition and those senses. And also the interesting thing is that abusers seem to have some kind of intuitive understanding of who dissociates more than others. And that's a part of the way that they pick their victims, is they're looking for people who dissociate easily because it's going to be easier to get them to comply and to abuse them. So some examples of the life threat were the virus was positioned as the life threat. And then, of course, that translated to people as the vectors of the virus are the life threat. Therefore, you should be terrified of other people who are going to kill you or killing other people because you would be irresponsible. And then for those of us on the other side who were more aware of what was going on, there's the actual life threat of tyranny that was happening. So I think all of us were affected by this, you know, even those of us who were more aware of what was going on, because naturally this was just happening through our nervous system. So the fourth and final parameter of the Stockholm syndrome and the state of captivity is the perceived inability to escape. So this fear bombardment and isolation and the intermittent reinforcement goes on over a period of time. Here, the key is that the target ends up feeling trapped and learns that resisting the abuse is more painful. The example of this is marital rape. Let's say a woman is in this marriage and she learns that her husband's going to rape her no matter what. And if she fights him, it only prolongs the pain. So she learns just to let him get it over with. And I don't know if you've heard anybody who went and got the vax and said, you know, I just wanted to get it over with. That's exactly what this is. The goal here is that the target develops a dependency on the perpetrator for survival. So in an abusive relationship, a partner might say, you can't survive without me. That could be a family system as well that says, you can't survive without us. You need us, or nobody else is going to love you. Nobody's going to want you but me. This induces the perception, again, over time, where a person's mind starts to think, I can't escape. I can't do that. I can't do anything. That essentially is the state of learned helplessness. So the result is the learned helplessness, which is like debility, dependency, dread, apathy, powerlessness, hopelessness, a sense of lack of control over your life, and also a loss of creativity and imagination and access to higher consciousness faculties. Because when we're locked in those lower states of consciousness, the fight, flight, freeze, and fawn, these are lower states of consciousness, and we're denied access to the higher states of consciousness, which is where we access the creativity, the critical thinking, the imagination, the intuition, all these amazing things that make us human. And by the way, all the very things that are going to help us get out of a situation like this, because if you can't imagine or create the way out or think your way out of there, how are you ever going to get out? So this essentially, it causes an existential exhaustion and despair. A person becomes so beaten down that they have no energy to even consider leaving the situation. And I think a perfect example is, you know, an abusive relationship where the target, and by the way, targets of abuse can be men and women. The target will leave the house multiple times a day. They go to work, they go to the grocery, they take the kids to school and activities, and they keep coming back. So again, it's not about physical confinement. It's the perception of confinement, the perception that you can't escape. And so what happens is when we can't escape, we turn to escapism tendencies. And these are all forms of self-destruction, whether it's engaging in fantasy or alcohol, porn, drugs, you know, other addictions that people have turned to. And we saw all of this skyrocketing over the last few years. And then the more severe examples of that would be self-harm and suicide. Again, we saw all of this escalating during the last few years. So some examples of that inability to escape, we call it goalpost moving. And that's what they did all along. It seemed like this was never ending. You know, it was 2 weeks to slow the spread or flatten the curve. And then it was a month, and then it just kept going. And then at first it was two doses of the vax, and then it was a booster, and then another. And essentially, the vax was positioned in the marketing as the only way out. Your only escape is to get the vax and you can go back to normal, which is why we saw marketing slogans on Google and YouTube that said, get back to what you love. And they would show you these images of families getting together and going to concerts and seeing your friends and having holidays together. So it was positioned as the way out. So the final result of all of this is essentially a state of spiritual bankruptcy. What does that mean? That means you finally get to this place where all faith is lost. When all faith is lost, the only thing left there is emptiness. And that state, that feeling of emptiness, is quite possibly the most devastating, painful, terrifying, lonely experience that a human could have. And I believe that this was intentional. And I think there was a great explanation of this state in a movie called The Neverending Story. It was from the 1980s. It was a beautiful kids movie. And it explained this. And the quotes in here were that the world was being destroyed. Essentially, there was this thing called the nothing that was wiping everything off the earth. And it was explained that people have begun to lose their hopes and forget their dreams. So this nothing grows stronger. What is the nothing? It's the emptiness that's left. It's like a despair destroying this world. Why? Because people who have no hopes are easy to control, and whoever has the control has the power. So that's why abusers have to get their target into that state of learned helplessness and spiritual bankruptcy. And that's exactly what happened in the last few years. So there's devastating long-term impact of this. You know, even though the COVID emergency ended last week, the accumulation and the consequences of what's happened is still ongoing. And I would say we're only starting to see the tip of the iceberg of the ramifications of this. Mm-hmm. So those escapism tendencies lead to more and more self-destruction habits. We're going to see this exacerbating. It also leads to ongoing compliance with abuse, which leads to more traumatization and more tyranny, because when we comply with tyranny, although some people think if you comply with the abuse is going to end, but that's not true. It just keeps feeding the abuse and tyranny. And essentially, it leads to the loss of self-worth, self-esteem, self-trust, our sense of self. It also increases our vulnerability, whether that be physical vulnerability and mental. And we're seeing a massive mental health decline. This is the next epidemic that's happening. We can see that all in the headlines. And this state of exhaustion, apathy, and powerlessness, you know, which was well exemplified in that movie, The Neverending Story. And then, of course, the high probability of repetition. We call it repetition compulsion, which is what Freud said we do on an individual level, which is why a person maybe is raised in an abusive family, and then they get in abusive relationship after abusive relationship in adulthood that keeps repeating because it's unconscious until they become aware of what's happening. And until they realize that there's a way out of that, they keep repeating the same. And that repetition compulsion on the individual level is history repeats itself on the collective level. And here we are again, repeating the same things that have happened so many times before in our human history. And so I want to clear up some liberation myths, because these are some common myths that people have when they're coming out of abusive relationships. And I hear a lot of people saying the same things now in society. Liberation is not just waking up, that the awareness is the first step to change. We have to become aware of what's wrong in order for us to take the actions to get new results, to change things in our life. So the awakening is not liberation. Liberation is also not when the truth comes out. So I think a lot of people think that, oh, as soon as that the truth finally comes out, it's all going to be over. We're going to be free again. Everything's going to be fine. Just like in an abusive relationship, when a person's trying to find out what's really going on, they're holding on to that truth as if that's going to be their liberation. But it's not. Because usually what happens is the abusers keep acting like nothing happened afterward. Liberation is also not just leaving the abuser or the abusive situation, because again, it's not physical confinement. That state of captivity can last years, decades, a lifetime after leaving the abusive relationship or situation, because we actually have to do the work to reprogram ourselves and clear that state from our psychology, our neurology, and our spirituality. Liberation is also not when the abusers are in jail or even dead, because again, that state is internal. It's not necessarily just an external state. And unfortunately, you know, a lot of victims of abuse and even people in the world today, we have these rescue fantasies sometimes. We're hoping that, you know, a savior or some group or some politician or somebody's going to save us and rescue us, and that's going to be liberation, but it's not. We actually have to save ourselves. So reclaiming the power of choice is our true liberation. This is where our power is, in our acts of choice. So I just want to give a few tips to people about what's the way out, because now we've learned how people got into that state of captivity. Probably all of us are recognizing to some degree we've all been affected by that, even if we've been more aware of what's going on in the recent years. So how do you get out of this state? First, it requires an ongoing commitment to self-responsibility. What does that mean? That means self-discipline of your thoughts, your words, your behaviors, your desires, and your choices. Self-responsibility is your empowerment. It's the threshold from the victim state into the survivor state. So in order to get over that threshold, we have to take self-responsibility. We can't keep looking outside ourselves for the solution or someone else to fix our life and save us. We have to do this ourselves. We also need to withdraw consent and opt out as much as possible. So when you're leaving an abusive relationship, we say go no contact, meaning completely cut that person out of your life. That can be really hard to do in some cases, particularly, let's say, a family system. Sometimes the person ends up having to leave the entire family system in order to start a new life. This is a lot more complicated in society because all of us are to some degree dependent on that whole matrix system. But the more we opt out, the better. We have to face the truth relentlessly. So this is in the early stages. This is what dissolves the cognitive dissonance, is the relentless facing of the truth. So in abusive relationships, I always advise people to write a sobriety list when they're trying to dissolve that cognitive dissonance. That sobriety list is like a bullet pointed list of all the things that this abusive person did to make you suffer. And just write down the sobriety list. And so that can apply, of course, to what's happened in the world. When you're trying to break through that cognitive dissonance and you still want to believe that the government or the media really has, you know, your best interest at hand, and maybe they're just incompetent and not malicious, read the sobriety list until suddenly that cognitive dissonance dissolves. And it's very visceral when it happens. It's like you feel it at a gut level. You suddenly sense that you've seen something that you can no longer unsee, and you're no longer going back and forth into the denial. So we also need to label the abuse and articulate what happened. We need to put words to the things that have happened so that we can make sense and create a story about what's happened. Because, you know, they call psychological abuse crazy making. It will literally drive you crazy because you've been subscribed to that reality of the perpetrator. This is everything that you've believed is true. And now you have to completely rewrite reality with terminology and words to explain that to yourself. And then you need to be able to speak the truth in order to find allies. Your allies are people who hear the truth that you're speaking and resonate with that. And of course, it's scary to speak the truth about abuse because very quickly you're going to identify who's your ally and who's not. You're going to also identify people who are still enabling the abusers, for example. But we need to find allies because, again, we need the social connection to be healthy physiologically, psychologically, spiritually. We need allies to keep us sane. We need people to talk to about what happened and what's still happening so that we don't feel isolated. And then, of course, it's important to set boundaries with the abusers and also their enablers. An abusive system is formed of abusers and their enablers, and actually it's the enablers that maintain that system. These are people who are either actively or passively doing the bidding of the abusers, and they become dangerous to your sanity and your well-being because they're like an extension of the abuser. They will abuse you by proxy. And also because that whole perception of reality and that mentality is extremely contagious. It's like a mind infection. It's like a virus of the mind that you can catch. And this one is actually contagious. So it's also important to create a new life separate from that abusive system. And again, this is the major challenge that we have nowadays. And I'm sure in the other 80 some talks that you're doing in this event, there are going to be people proposing ideas for new systems that are coming out, whether healthcare, education, food, all the different things that we need to live as human beings and thrive in this life. it's important that we create these systems that are separate from that abusive system, because if we keep relying on that, we're going to have to, in some way, comply with the abuse in order to survive. And I think this is the big challenge we have in society, because a lot of us are still in the cognitive dissonance on this. And I'll admit, I am myself. It's hard to admit that we may not be able to rely on those systems anymore, because that's all we've ever known. And it's scary and it's new and it's unknown. But I think that it's really important that we invest our energy and time in creating these new systems so that we can not only survive, but thrive ongoing. And of course, we're going to have to rebuild the self-worth and work on the personal trauma recovery. The self-worth is the absolute foundation of the recovery after abuse. And there's a very simple equation to rebuild your self-worth. It starts by identifying your values. In other words, what matters to you? What's really important? And actually write those things down, because you might think that you know them, but maybe you haven't really articulated it to yourself. And when you're looking at it on paper, it's a whole different thing. So what really matters to you? Then you need to set standards and boundaries to protect those values. And what matters to you? What's the difference between a standard and a boundary? The standard is the yes, and the boundary is the no. So the standard shows you what that value ought to look like in real life. And the boundary is the line that says up to here. This is where it stops. The personal trauma recovery, of course, is more than just rebuilding self-worth. That's the foundation. We have to start building the foundation before we can build the rest of that structure. This is a lot more complex. It takes time and it happens in layers, but essentially the work involves facing what happened, truly facing it, acknowledging what happened, feeling all the feelings as they come up, because again, those feelings got stuffed. They got numbed in order to survive the extremely intense and stressful situations we've been through. It got numbed in the nervous system, and it's not all going to come out at once. That would be overwhelming. There are built-in, I would say, wise, almost like structures or programs in our nervous system that know only to let a little bit out at a time, which is why the healing happens in layers. And so as we allow those feelings to come up and we feel them, essentially it's like a grieving and a mourning process that has to happen. And there's no rushing that. And everybody has their own timeline, you know, as they process these things. And then eventually we have to rewrite the story. That's going to be how we get into the thriving. And so once we can get into that thriving and we're rewriting the story, now we're able to transmute that trauma into a new sense of purpose. We're able to look back almost with gratitude about what happened, not because we would wish that on someone else and not because we'd want to go through that again, but because we can look back and we can acknowledge that something beautiful came of that. And I think probably everyone listening can relate. Like if you think of your life before 2020 and you think of who you are now, imagine, look at the personal development that's happened since then. Look at all the changes you've made in your life. You know, I thought I was following my purpose before 2020, but I wasn't entirely. I didn't realize my desires weren't in order and I was chasing after a lot of the wrong things. I didn't realize I was surrounding myself with some of the wrong people that weren't really aligned with where I'm going in life or the thriving that I want to have in life. And so all of the things that we've restructured and changed in our own personal lives, there have been some silver linings. And when you can feel that sense of gratitude, that's when you know you're truly becoming a warrior. You're truly starting to thrive. You're over that next threshold in your recovery. And of course, remembering that your choices create your legacy. Right? So every choice that you make creates your personal legacy, which is why it's so important to think about how your choices are creating your legacy and how they're contributing to your family, your community, your country, and the world. Not that you need to have some grand, you know, healing the world kind of desire, though that there's nothing wrong with that if you do, but meaning that even just in your family, that is no small thing. Your choices are affecting and contributing to the social system around you. And that's extremely important. So I think it's helpful to think, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the road, what story do you want to be telling the children, the grandchildren, those who weren't yet born during this time or don't remember what happened, what you were doing and what your role was in all of this. That's your legacy. And that comes with the choices that you're making. And remember, your choices are your empowerment. That's where we find power. And that's where we find our liberation.
Meredith, that was a beautiful, beautiful presentation. Especially the ending there. I think a lot of this information can be really almost daunting to sort through, right? To really come to terms with what happened. But the way you laid out some solutions there, I think was such a perfect way to end this presentation, contextualize it. I do have one question pertaining to psychological manipulation. I want to say first, just as for clarification, we want people to come to their own perspective on everything that happened. But with the end of COVID, we're laying it out as we see it, the team behind the end of COVID and all the speakers and everyone that we're hosting. So with that, we do come from the perspective that there's no proof of the virus. Now, operating under that premise, could it be that the seeming admission of the mainstream now that there was a quote gain of function lab made virus, and what looked like alternative, some of the most prominent alternative voices being censored originally, and many of them probably really did believe there was a gain of function virus, right? So I want to be clear on that there's a lot of people who genuinely believe that, and that's totally fine. I would say most people do. But now that the mainstream is seeming to acknowledge that, and it looks like the alternative side that was censored so heavily is now being validated, and there's some vindication happening, right? And also the understanding that the gain of function narrative carries a much more fear-inducing weight to it into the future, because the idea that there's a gain of function virus versus a natural virus that jumps from a bat to a pangolin or whatever the story is much scarier than the natural version. Of course, there's no proof for either of those, but I'd love to hear your comments, again, operating under that premise. And I know you have your own perspective, and I want everyone to have their own perspective, but if what we're posing is true, and they are now admitting that, quote, the virus was made in a lab, could there be some psychological manipulation going on there?
For sure. I think there's two things. One, like you said, it's the fear element. So it's just another bombardment of fear where, you know, people think that there's this lab made virus and it's this, what do they call it? Unprecedented virus, you know, novel coronavirus that was meant to terrorize us. But also for those who do believe in that, it seems to be a perceived act of kindness, right? It seems like a little truth that's coming out and you're like, oh, yay. You know, and you get that hope again that they're admitting the truth and that, you know, everything is ending and all of these things. So I think there could be multiple purposes for releasing that. And also it could just be a misdirection. It could be completely false and it could be misdirecting us to look at something else while they're doing something else. Because that's always what abusers do, is they'll create some kind of distraction over here while they're doing something.
Appease you temporarily over here or distract you with something over here while something else is going on the flip side of that.
Yeah, you know, and it's all related to what every abuser does is they destroy every pillar of the target's life. So they create all these fires, right? And if they're distracting you with the fire over here, you're not able to put out the fire over here. And I think that's what we're about to segue into now is all these other things, the economy, the war, the food, the next pandemic, you know, all these things, they're attacking every pillar of human life because they have to collapse that in order to completely lock the target into that state of captivity.
Well, I loved what you said there about taking self-responsibility for like how you think, act, how you behave, who you interact with and what you consume, both physically and emotionally, mentally and spiritually. And I think at this point in time, in order to counteract what's going on, we need to take that self-responsibility and amplify it by 100 for ourselves, for our families, for our communities, and no longer focus on the nonsense that they're doing. Of course, that's what we're doing with the end of COVID, is laying out, okay, here's all the things that happened so that we're fully aware, here's how we move forward, which the last three modules were focusing heavily on solutions and health and in freedom, really leading people towards a new way of being. So I think this presentation that you've given is a perfect piece of context to sort of underpin really all that happened with the mainstream COVID narrative. So thank you so much for this presentation. It was amazing.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. And if you like this presentation by Meredith, please be sure to subscribe to her list and check out her work below. Stay tuned for more.